A young folks roll on the little cabin floor.
I never asked you to do anything that I wasn't willing to stand up and say I'm for it too. And come on, not you go do it and leave me out. But you come on, let's do it. And then let's be responsible for what we do.
And tonight I want to acknowledge our gratitude to Almighty God and to our people and to our determination. We'll not fail them.
But I do not intend ever to be a candidate for public office in this lifetime again.
A Kentucky legend. The Chandler Years. The life of Happy Chandler told in sound. This is the radio biography of one of the outstanding figures in Kentucky history. In this hour, Governor Chandler relives major events in his life, brought to mind by rare recordings from the WHAS radio archives. Others who were part of the Chandler story add their points of view. In a moment, the early years growing up in Kentucky.
Well, I was born on a small farm about a mile north of this town. You know, they always say that I'm from Carden. Well, that's natural, but I was born in the country on a hill about a mile north of this little town of Carden, which was 700 or 800 at that time, about equally divided between black and white. And my father was a farmer, small farmer, and we owned the farm. They've said he was a tenant farmer, and if he had been, I would have said so. That was not so. We all worked for everybody. I worked on the farm, and we all worked for everybody in the neighborhood, you understand? I was born on the Diamond Island Road. My mother and father separated when I was 4, and she went away, and I didn't see her for 31 years. And my father undertook the task of raising 2 little boys, which he did quite well, we thought. My daddy was superintendent of the Sunday school there, and he always went and cut the grass on the churchyard all the time. And finally, when he got one of those grass cutters that operated as with a motor, you understand, cut all the top fingers off his hand one day when he grabbed a stick and it pulled it in there, and I went down to see him. Of course, I was distressed, and He had great character, great courage. I was trying to figure out what I'd say to him, to tell him how sorry I was. And when I was, as the book says, yet afar off, he held up his hand and said, "Son, look how much I got left." I was nicknamed by the people of that community Irish. Yeah, I was called Irish Chandler. And, of course, I was Scotch-Irish, and that was quite natural. And I delivered the newspapers. I delivered the newspapers in that little town. And I played baseball every day. Dr. Homer W. Carpenter came down there and made a speech at the high school. He was a Christian preacher, and a great Christian preacher. And at that time, he was the chancellor of Transylvania College. And he said a fellow that wanted to go to school, had courage enough to go, could make it. He could work his way. My daddy was not too enthusiastic about that. He thought that I was going far away, and he thought a high school education would be sufficient. And he's rather favored. So, but I decided to go try it, and so I left Carden in 1917. So the old story that I got to Lexington in the summer of July the 1st, by the way, about 1917, with a $5 bill and a red sweater and a smile, is almost literally true. I worked in the mill. I got $1.25 a day for carrying 440 100-pound sacks of shell corn with a Bill Blunder, who was a big black boy friend of mine, older than I was. And he was always proud of me because there wasn't very many white boys that did that kind of work. And I built up strong arms, strong muscles, which I fortunately still have. But I got those for hard work, you know. You don't get those staying around the pool halls, you know. I got my degree in a Bachelor of Arts in History and Political Science at Transylvania. And got my 3 years later, I got my law degree.
Happy was playing third base for Lawrenceburg. I was playing center field for Bardstown.
That's a fellow named Hubbard. I can still see him with his back turned to the infield. I hit two in my life to right center field. That means that you probably hit an outside pitch, you know. And this one I hit off Rudy Summers, who was a American League baseball pitcher for the Boston Red Sox, and Hubbard turned around, and he's still living in Louisville. He turned and raced to right center, and it was an open field, and he almost got away out of the ballpark. He reached up his hand up away over his head, and I was around in first base when he caught the ball, and he caught it all right, but God, he robbed me.
It was a real close game, and Happy hit one left center field or center field somewhere, and it must have had a little height on it, but I got back under it and caught it. And Happy always accused me of playing pretty deep to begin with, and then making a marvelous catch. Well, I wouldn't deny making a marvelous catch if he wanted to brag on it and so forth, but they didn't have any fences close around there, and the ball didn't go out of the park.
Oh, he took a home run right away from me, you know.
And I didn't have to get a Pony Express man to go get the ball and bring it back in. I mean, they had room enough for me to maneuver, and I caught the ball.
I played with Lexington in the Bluegrass League, and I had a tryout once with Saskatoon in the West Canadian League in 1920. I had a tryout with Saskatoon. I pitched for Grafton, North Dakota in the Red River Valley League, and I won 12 of 13 games and pitched a no-hitter against the Monoman Indians for 7 innings, and that was all the game that was, 7 innings. It finished, and I got a 7-inning no-hit game. And I enjoyed my baseball up there, of course, being a fellow from the deep south going up and playing on the Canadian border with those North Dakota fellas. They had never seen a fellow like me, you know, and they'd always say, "Where are you all from?" You know, and I was a scout for Uncle Charlie Moran for about and the Center College people for 10 or 12 years. After I came back here, when I was coaching over here, I scouted for them. Now the scout goes ahead of the team and watches the other team play, and I thought I had some coaching talents, and it'll show. I won 36 games here, you know, and lost 15 and tied 5, you know, and that's still the record here. And then I coached actively at Center College. I was over there in 1927, and I coached the freshman team, and I applied for the head coach's job when my head coach resigned. He told me he was going back to Washington, Hod Opstee, an All-American end from Wisconsin, and he was my good friend, and I told him, I said, under no circumstances would I apply for this job unless you're certain you're not going to reapply for it. And he said, I'm not going to. And he recommended me, but Dr. Turk didn't give it to me. He gave it to somebody else. And if he had given it to me, I still might be a football coach. Well, I tell you, I think the thing that had more to do with it than anything else, I lost the last game to Kentucky Wesleyan 7-6. A boy named Gallagher threw a pass from behind the 50-yard line, his own. We had the game 1-6-0, and the clock was going up within 10 seconds of the final gun. I can still see it. He threw the pass, and I thought the fella caught it in Garrett County, but the referee said he caught it in the end zone. They kicked the point after the game was over and beat me 7-6. And Dick Gallagher, who's been the head of the Hall of Fame at Canton, Ohio for the football people, wrote me a card or a letter every year for 25 years and said, "You remember me, I'm the guy that made a governor out of you." It's a cute story. It was a true story. I didn't get the football job, so I came back and got elected governor.
A Kentucky legend, the Chandler years, continues in just a moment with Politics in the 1930s.
Well, I had not intended to go into politics.
in those early days, fella, I used to say facetiously that I was a lawyer by profession. I made a living coaching football. And indeed, that was partially true. And so I came here 55 years ago. And I made my first political speech from the back end of a spring wagon at Millville in the John Davis campaign in 1922. And Millville's a little country town down here, halfway between Versailles and Frankfort. And from then on, I just sort of got interested in it. I didn't run for office, though, until 1929. That was 7 years later. I was elected state senate. That's a four-year term. In 1929, I was elected quite easily. I had a Democratic opponent in three counties, Scott, Jessman, and Woodford, and a Republican opponent, but no difficulty. We got a tremendous majority in. I went to the state senate 47 years ago this year now, and took my seat there in January of 1930. You may be interested to know, I think there are only two of us living that voted for the preservation of Cumberland Falls. The Insel people, who were utilities people from Chicago, had wanted to build a power plant at Cumberland Falls. And I'll never forget, I made a speech in the Senate in which I said that I thought this would be a tragedy, because the Cumberland Falls is really something special. And I said, if we permitted it, they'd have a damn site and we wouldn't have a damn thing. And as it turned out, that's the way it would have been, because they failed. That was a business that failed. And no telling what would have happened to us and to them. And I don't think there's but one other fellow living. And I think that's a former attorney general named Beverly Vincent, who lives in Brownsville.
And when they called the roll, I expected Happy Chandler, since he represented the Lexington district, to vote with the power trust. And when they called his name, he said, some of you people have figured that I belong to the power trust. I belong to the people of Kentucky. And I'm going to vote to free Cumberland Falls and leave it like God wanted to be. A great natural wonder. And I want the people to have a state park there where all the people will own it. That was the decided vote. And we won that battle by one vote, and Happy Chandler was cast that one vote. So he is the father of the first state park in Kentucky.
There were Democratic factions in Kentucky, and they had been at each other's throats. And Senator Camden, who lived just a mile from here, Senator Camden came to me at church one day and said, how would you like to be lieutenant governor? And I said, who, me? You know, I was shocked and surprised. And I said, well, I had just finished one session of the Senate, you understand. I had another year to go on my Senate term. And this was 1931. And the first session was just over. I guess that's got to be attributed to luck, maybe, being in the right place at the right time. 1935. That was the political campaign heard around the world. That was the only time in the history of Kentucky politics that three races were required in order to select a nominee and bring about the election of a governor. And I was a candidate in the first primary and qualified as one of the two candidates selected to run in the final, and then ran in the second primary in September against Mr. Ray from Russellville and won the nomination. And then I was elected governor of Kentucky in November of that year. My opponent was Judge King Swope from Lexington. Early that year, the committee had met and decided to have a nominating convention. Well, that meant that Governor LeFoon would name his successor, because the governor always controls the Democratic committee. The Courier-Journal and Mr. Roosevelt and some others Of course, Mr. Roosevelt was interested in it because he was going to run for re-election, and he wanted to carry Kentucky, and he had a good base here. They decided that they would try to find out if the people of Kentucky wanted a convention, so they took a poll, and the Courier Journal took that poll, and I think Judge Bingham paid for it. I'm not sure, but I expect he did. Barry would know, Senior, if you'd ask him, he would know.
It's much easier for the bosses to control a party convention than it is to control a primary. And some of those state conventions in the old days were pretty rough and tumble affairs, and it didn't seem that the general voter, the general public, got a very good shake out of them. The bosses in both parties pretty well controlled things. So it had long been the conviction of our papers that it would be a good thing to have both parties go into having party primaries. In 1935, this issue became a very hot one in Kentucky, and the papers decided to put on a poll of their readers to find out what the sentiments would be on that subject. Now, I can't pretend that this was actually a scientific poll. Well, anyway, we went ahead and took the poll in the Courier Journal and did it as fairly and as we knew how. And the poll came out overwhelmingly in favor of having a primary rather than a convention. Now, it happened that that was very much favorable to Happy's cause at that time, but that was not the particular reason why it was done.
They took that poll, and that poll showed overwhelmingly that the people of Kentucky wanted a primary. They wanted the right to vote. Mr. Hop Holman, who was the governor's secretary, called me about 8 o'clock and said, Governor Happy? And he said, yes. He said, this is Hop Holman. I said, how do, Mr. Holman? And he said, I have a message for you. At 9 o'clock, the governor's going to cross the state line at Ashland. He's on the way to Washington, and you'll be the governor. I just wanted you to know that I'm at your service. He gave me his telephone number. He said, the office is closed for tonight. I assume, he said, you'll come down in the morning. I said, yes, Mr. Holman, I don't anticipate unless some emergency comes. And I'll just stay here, but in the morning, early, I'll be there. And we got up the next morning. Both of us go to Frankfurt. He was auditor. Dan Talbert was the state auditor. On the way down there, we looked at each other, and I said, what would you think of we calling the legislature into extraordinary session for the purpose of passing a primary bill, a compulsory primary bill to force a vote, to let the people of Kentucky have a vote on their public officials?
Well, he said, looked at me this way, he said, I think that'd be pretty good. He said, well, we talked and got out of Frankfurt. I called called one of my secretaries and got a legal cap, that yellow legal paper, long paper, and went into my office and wrote it out in long hand. I didn't want to give it to a secretary. I didn't want to trust anybody. And the only fellow that had an idea that I might do it was Dan Talbert, and he'd gone to his office. And when I finished it, I called Howard Henderson, who was the chief correspondent for the Courier Journal, and gave him a copy of it. So they went into session, and strange it may seem, I had called for a single primary. So then they proposed a double barrel primary. They had no chance unless they showed the people that they were for a primary. We were certain to have a primary then of some character or some description. So when they put up the two primary bill, our fellows didn't vote, and then they didn't have enough to pass that. But after the original roll call, we supplied them enough, and we gave them enough, and we passed the two primary. Now that meant that we were going to have two primaries that year. Primary election, they ran ahead the first primary. I beat him about 28,000 the second primary, just a month later.
The first term as governor and on to the Senate, as the Chandler years continues shortly.
Joe Larry came from Grant County, Kentucky, and he joined me in my first political campaign for governor in 1935. He made speeches for me.
I made many speeches for him out at the back end of trucks, in beer gardens, and in alleys, and anywhere, as it is written somewhere in Holy Writ, that three or more were gathered together in his name, I made a speech. This was my first venture, and a very happy one. Happy in more sense, and this is not intended to be a pun, happy in more sense than in the name of the candidate, because... In the years that have intervened, I have participated more or less actively in politics and enjoyed every minute of it.
And after the election, he came to Frankfort as the sixth assistant attorney general, which I believe was the last one they had. And during all the time, all the years that have passed since then, he's been my faithful and steadfast friend. He was my advisor. And he was sober and discreet and a very strong religious man. And I have profited greatly by my association with him.
As a candidate, Chandler was truly a populist. Chandler cared not a whit whether the county judge or the county attorney or any of the county officials was for him. Chandler, to take a homespun example, would come to Frankfort, and he would spend his time in front of the local drugstore across the street at Main and St. Clair. He said the greatest street intersection in the world, Main and St. Clair and Frankfort. Well, the first person that came along, in all likelihood, Chandler knew him. And as soon as the word got around that Chandler was in town, a crowd gathered, 40, 50 people. If, perchance, a colored preacher came along, Chandler had it made. He and the preacher sang, "Swing Low, Sweet Chariot." And by that time, he had quite a crowd of people. And Chandler was a candidate of enormous appeal to the rank and file of people, the greatest I have ever known.
We were $30 million in debt in December of 1935. I fired 9 or 10,000 people. That's a harsh word, but I relieved them of their job. Well, I asked a fellow the other day whether I saw in Logan County. He said, "I've hated you for 40 years. And I said, "Well, I don't blame you." He said, "You fired me in 1935. He was a Ray supporter. I'd fire those fellows, you know. That's par for the course, you know. So I said, "Well, now that you look at it back, which had you rather had, be relieved of your job or not paid?" And I said, "I had no money." Well, he said, "It's all right with me now, Governor." He said, "I'm not mad." And of course, 40 years have passed. And he said, "I'd did pretty well. It probably was the best thing ever happened to me, although I didn't like it, and I was mad with you." You understand? Well, I said, I know, I understand that. But I either had to get rid of these people, because I had no money to pay them, and we were $30 million in debt. But then I started to reorganize the government, as I had promised to do. And if I may say so, I don't think anything in this lifetime has been more effective, and even today, than our reorganization of state government in 1936. We prepared the budget carefully. I prepared four during my lifetime, two and one in 36, and one in 38, and one in 56, and one in 58. That's four budgets. And we underspent every one of them and lived within our income and kept a balanced budget. 1938, that's the Senate campaign against Senator Barkley.
I know that there isn't a single citizen of Kentucky who doesn't approve of an administration that isn't afraid to tackle the problems of the people of this state, isn't willing to be held responsible for every official act that is done by the chief executive or the legislature, and that isn't willing to take the responsibility and stand the gaff and face the gun anytime. And these boys will tell you, every one of them, "Joe, I never asked you to do anything that I wasn't willing to stand up there and say I'm for it too. And come on, not you go do it and leave me out, but you come on, let's do it. And then let's be responsible for what we do."
I did. I don't know where I made that speech, but that's important, you know, I think. A lot of governors will order you to do things that they wouldn't do themselves.
Unfortunately for us, we didn't make a good one of that one. Well, we made a good one, but the President of the United States and the Courier Journal and its associates all conspired to cause us to lose that race, and that's the first race we ever lost.
I promised you that if you'd elect me, I'd reorganize the state government. Well, did I do it? Yes, sir. I fired... I fired 9,000 people just after I got to Frankfort and didn't create a vacancy. And by saving the people's money, we've reorganized the state government from top to bottom. I prepared for you, with the help of the Democratic legislature, a sensible budget. That budget makes adequate appropriations for public health, public charities, public schools. This year, public schools in Kentucky will get more support from the state than they've gotten since 1792 in Kentucky.
They didn't dispute that. I tell you again, I say I didn't make a reputation being a liar, and I refused to tell them anything that we were not doing or that I hadn't done. You know, I was forthright with them as I could be.
I commenced the campaign in good humor, with high hopes of success. I have not gotten mad during the campaign. My opponents have gotten mad. They have conducted a bitter campaign.
Barkley, I wouldn't have run against him except he was no damn good, and never was. If we've got to make national heroes out of Leo DeRocher and Albert Barkley, well, you have to leave me out.